Check. 4, 5, 6.
Mm-hmm.
Check. 4,
Zach,
3.
Kate, Eric,
Micah.
Goats.
Yeah, I checked it instead of plastic.
I like it, Micah. A little different.
We're different this week. We're talking to you on Monday. Hey, hello, everybody. Game of Bones. We're here.
Game of Bones.
Got it out.
It's like they've called us and we've just picked up the phone. Game of Bones.
We're a podcast, guys.
Thank you for listening. We're a podcast. This is what you're listening to. Hopefully, your favorite color is blood or white today, or snow. Ooh. The color of snow.
Yes.
Or your favorite color might be Jon Snow.
That's not a color. That's a character on Game of Thrones.
That's the color of love.
There was some of that in this episode, though. So I guess that applies.
Yeah. You know, it's funny to see the juxtaposition of all this talk about girls and love and loving girls, and also then with the deaths of so many men of the Night's Watch and the Northern Territories.
Yeah, do you want to get right into it? Let's just do this.
Is there any other way?
Are we talking about the love? Are we talking about how Maester Aemon just told Sam the fact that he was a pimp back in his day?
Yeah. Well,
he was
in line to be king. It's a real panty melter. When you are next in line for the throne, ladies just line up. And I did think that that conversation with Maester Aemon had what I have identified to be the theme of this episode, which is one of my favorite things, basically everybody's panties got melted by the biggest fire the North has ever seen. What I was going to say is that line, love is the death of duty. We see that several times, throughout this episode, both that and its inverse. And we also see Sam himself able to straddle that line. The most unlikely character to be able to do it, I think, because he's been painted so much as this cowardly person who doesn't know how to swing a sword. He's going to be completely useless in battle. And yet he was kind of a badass throughout this whole episode. From start
to finish.
He was
a certified badass.
He was.
He's certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Can they do that for characters now?
Sam was fucking fresh. He was. And he was able to juggle his love of Gilly, his love of John, and his duty to the Wall and to the Night's Watch. And I don't think that he fell victim to either side of that equation, but other characters did. Most notably, Ygritte. I think she's the one who was not able to do her duty because of the love that she felt.
Not so much as Janos Slynt, though, unable to do his job, right, although it wasn't for love. So I think you're right there on Ygritte. But in terms of just being incapable of acting, you know, it's remarkable to see Pip and the other men of the Night's Watch, who are clearly scared and they have conversations about how scared they are, still end up, you know, fighting to their deaths or uncertainty, you know, going up against the unknown or the known, which in this case are huge woolly mammoths and giants, and, you know, giving it their all, as opposed to Slynt, who, you know, is really just
craven.
He's really craven.
I wanted to ask, do you guys know, we're talking about Maester Aemon a second ago, and I have a note here. I know that he chose to give up being a Targaryen and to go to the Wall, to be a Maester there. Do we know why?
Could it be that it wasn't a choice?
This was explained. We talked about it during our read through of, I think it was a Game of Thrones, and also inside of, I think the little snippet that we got from the show just during season one, where we got to learn of his lineage, that it was sort of a personal decision for him.
And also a personal decision to, I believe, stay there, right? Through times of crisis. Like he would have a bloodline to claim should he choose to, but it would constitute abandoning his brothers.
Yeah, it was the same decisions. I mean, John was talking about the hardship that was happening with his family and what Rob was doing in his campaign during the War of the Five Kings. And John was reasoning with him and, I guess, trying to give him his perspective on why he should leave the Wall. And this is where Maester Aemon was basically like, listen, I've lived through my own share of shit happening.
Yes.
The large rebellion where your father was part of this whole storybook ending, that was my family.
I'm glad that you mentioned storybooks, because one of the scenes that I feared we would see tonight It was the burning of the library. I mean, if everything else in the wall is on fire, at least Maester Aemon's favorite place appears to still be intact. I don't know. Small victories, right, guys?
I guess. I mean, I don't really care about that. But, you know, with Slint, you brought him up. And I think it says a lot about him, not only that he went and cowered, you know, the same place that Gilly was locked away in, but the fact that when Sam shows up later on, it's Gilly who jumps to defend herself and her baby, and Slint still cowering in the corner.
Right.
Yeah.
He's had a complete mental breakdown. You know, he's on top of the wall and he's put in command by Alistair Thorne, and he's talking to John, and John says, you know, there's giants on mammoths coming in. They don't give a crap about your 4-inch cold rolled steel. And Slint has this dreamy look in his eyes, and he was like, there's no such thing as giants. Mm-hmm. It's a storybook. It's a fable for children. And that's when Gren is like, I'll take care of this. But I think that he's cowering because he's out of it. He's completely gone. He's a cowardly man anyway. We've known this about him. But he's breaks.
It was so important though, because that goes back to really the perspective of everybody who is south of the wall.
Yes.
Like they don't think that anything north of the wall that they've heard stories about are actually real.
Right.
You know, we see this happen all the time in King's Landing, different people talking about, you know, grumpkins and
snarks,
giants and mammoths and all these other things. They don't really exist. They're figments of people's imaginations. They're stories that get told when kids get put to sleep to scare them a little bit. But no,
that's nice.
Janus, they're actually real. And, you know, he was head of the city watch, and, you know, he wasn't much of a leader there either. Remember, he betrays Ned.
Right.
He does the cowardly thing, which is to side with the side that has more power.
Right, and more money. But ultimately, you could say that he's in part responsible for what happened to Ned. And, you know, he goes up to the wall, and his behavior is really no different. I mean, he's just as cowardly.
Yeah.
And he looks to save himself before trying to fight for the cause. And, you know, the complete opposite of that, I have to say, I think we should all give it up for Elizer Thorne in this episode.
Absolutely.
Because he answered the call, man. He answered the bell. He was there. He was ready to fight.
Yeah.
He was seriously injured, but, you know, he stood for his men.
Now, can somebody explain, unless it's a clear spoiler, what happened to Thorne here? Because I recall seeing him getting carried away almost inward to the compound by three men or so. It looked like he was being taken to the kitchen. I mean, I had a terrible thought that those guys were going to kill him and eat him. they carried him inward. Did they not carry him like inside? I was like, man, they're taking him straight to the kitchen. Sure. They keep talking about how they're eating people. Like, that was a terrible thought I had, but I'm like, where else? Why would they take him instead of killing him?
I don't think they'd like stop and have a snack in the middle of this battle, though.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about it.
Just a mouthful.
I don't think it's not clear what's happened to Sir Alistair.
Except later, the day after, the next morning, they say he has fallen. So, I mean, they could be mistaken, or they've done a body count. You know, the one thing that I kind of wanted out of the end of this episode, you know, the last few episodes have had so many numbers. We know exactly 100,000, and it's a rough estimate, but still, it's numbers. We don't know how many men fell out of the 102 that were on the wall after an entire episode that didn't even leave this setting. We don't have a body count.
If I had to guess from the battle, I would say about 700 men fell.
Like, out of 102?
Yes, out of 102. It seemed like way too many dudes were dying for how many. Like, at some point, they're like, we need more men from atop the wall to fight down here. I was like, you don't have anybody else. They're all down here. Who else are you gonna? And then they send men from up top. I'm like, where did they come from? There's nobody up there. So it was hard to get a sense of the scale of this battle. And I know that this set must be incredibly difficult to work with. I felt like it felt confined. The battle felt like it was raging all over the place, but Castle Black isn't huge. And so you had this snowy set. You had the set for the top of the wall. And then there was the one long shot. Did you guys see
the panorama?
See? Yeah, it was the panoramic, like 360 degree.
So good.
It was super good. And I was struck by how much work went into choreographing that scene. It was really nice.
They really stepped up the entire episode. The top of the wall obviously being rebuilt and refinished for this entire episode. Right. We got to see the walking and talking at the very beginning. Such a great use of space and showing.
I think my favorite thing about the top of the wall stuff was the scythe. I did not anticipate them having that awesome weapon baked into the wall. Essentially, they're like, well, we gotta do it now. And then they have perfect timing and they slice all the wildlings off the wall and they just explode in a blood mist.
You know, the terrible joke that that's going to play is in daylight, it's going to look like the bottom of a smiley face on the wall.
Oh, God.
It was Red John.
Well,
has anybody ever seen The Mentalist?
There's that Mentalist reference right there for you. People say we gave up on our references of other, you know, or new.
Zelda's done. Harry Potter's done. But who says that? I think, you know, putting all of this into one episode, completely unique. Eric, you mentioned it just before, but the fact that we don't leave one place for an entire episode. It's never happened before, I don't think.
I mean, even Blackwater had cutaways and had Daenerys, right. Didn't it? I mean,
does this count as like a bottle episode? Am I using that term correctly?
I think you are.
But in the books, the attack from the south happens first, and that's kind of its own chapter. And then you get the attack coming from the north. So it's a little bit different in terms of how it plays out in sequence. It's not everything happening at one time like you have in this episode. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I think it works for TV and it works for the episode to have them happening at the exact same time. It makes for more action, makes for more energy. And I thought amazing this episode overall, just in terms of the battle. The fact that I saw a bunch of tweets afterwards that Brian Cogman was retweeting the fact that, you know, movies that spend hundreds of millions of dollars on battle scenes, you know, this TV show was able to do it right with a much smaller budget in a much shorter period of time. So, you just have to give kudos to those who produced and made this episode.
Yeah,
that's really one of the biggest takeaways from this episode is that I know that we had kind of a slower pace at the end that was abruptly thrown upon us, but for a good long while there, we were in a continuous action-packed frenzy where there wasn't 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 second shots of trees or pretty landscapes to cut around to and spend some time, because that's the normal padding that you see in television. And if you watch other shows, you'll notice it being a lot less polished than Thrones, but we've come to expect a little more. So coming into this episode and seeing the exact scale that they did make all of this on, I was very, very heavily impressed. And on top of that, the fight choreography, I thought, was just leagues and bounds above anything they'd done yet, and it was really, really cool to see.
I mean, everybody in every scene had a sword in hand or a bow, and you're just wondering, and you could follow, the camera followed these arrows from the bow to the victim. Almost every time an arrow was shot, you saw exactly where it went, you know, who fired it, and you really got a sense of space. This is the first time I feel like I'm seeing Castle Black for the first time. Because there's angles, and obviously the whole, you know, with the panorama, the whole courtyard, it had to be developed for this episode. And like, we've never seen these things before. You know, they were always there on the other side. You know, the camera's just not facing that direction. But to have to develop it in all of the, three dimensions and then choreograph a fight scene, absolutely 100%. Very a complicated thing to do, but very successful, I think.
On top of the panorama shot, and I think you guys are talking about the one where it was in the courtyard and it was like following him through the staircases and the doorways, and that was awesome. But I really, really felt like those amazing. Do you remember when they were like, "What's that sound from behind?" And the camera lifts and basically does an aerial view, showing us for the first time the entire view of Castle Black, and then shows all of the guys running from the south toward the front gate of Castle Black. And I was like, "Oh my God!" And then, you know, the camera starts going down toward it, and the music gets much more violent. It was just like, "Whoa, this is TV for a minute. I like this."
Yeah, when the wildlings come from the south and climb over the walls.
Oh, that was intense.
That was intense. Yeah, that was probably the really scariest moment for me. I was like, oh my God. Tormund is a terrifying character, and all the Fens are awful. And it was an interesting contrast to see. Pip says at one point that he's never fought with a blade that had a real edge. And that took me aback, actually, for a moment. I was like, what are they training with at Castle Black? Like, are they just training with practice swords? And it pissed me off. I was like, well, maybe you guys should have swung a real sword now and again. But also, I mean, but, and I'm sure somebody will tear me apart for, well, Pip was a not.
He actually played with an edge sword.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was interesting to see the difference between these battle hardened wildlings and the castle trained Night's Watch. Because many of them, you know, they've had scenes in the past where they're all fighting in the courtyard and Sir Alistair is drilling them, right? And so I feel like that's been what they've been practicing for, but they could not anticipate the insanity that was going to be heaped on them by these wildlings who all they do is kill and eat and sleep, right?
I think what really shines through in this episode is the fact that a command structure and the organization of the Night's Watch is the only thing that saved them, or was certainly the most dominating factor.
Right.
Because, and it's pointed out, you know, obviously in the dialogue, I'm not, you know, reaching too far hard to find this, but, you know, when they say that the wildlings lack organization or direction, at such a micro level, and then you see people up top of the wall sending people down, you know, John asking for reinforcements, or Sam asking John for reinforcements and him doing it, mm-hmm. you know, all of these things that happen in this episode that serve to win the battle for the crows really wouldn't exist if it weren't for this rigid structure that was sort of imparted upon all brothers. And furthermore, they're everything like when they're guarding the tunnel, you know, trying to defend the tunnel with the giant, and they start reciting the oath, the five men, reciting the
chills.
Oath. Again, yeah, it's all so about good. The structure. It's about your oath. It's about something grander than just sort of the hack 'em up, you know, defend yourself. It's the duty of it all.
I wish that we had been able to see that fight with the giant and with Gren.
I just assumed he was going to knock the gate down and it would squash them all.
Yeah, I thought that too. It looked like that's kind of what happened.
Yeah. Well, what happened last week was too much, so they thought that they keep
too many eyes.
Gore to a minimum.
Well, you know, the budgetary restrictions for breaking cold rolled steel is just like outrageous, so they just decided to cut away for that moment.
Do you guys think that the violence in this episode was greater than the violence in the last episode?
I don't. I think that this, and Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I had this exact thought. I was like, I feel a bit like we have a certain expectation when it comes to the level of gore and how disgusting we're ready for Game of Thrones to be every week now. And it reached new highs last week. And so having people showing the Fens wielding battle axes and slamming them into people's throats, I mean, like maybe 6 weeks ago that would have grossed me out. But now there's no, I'm just like,
you've seen them do enough reckless killing. You're like, people are fighting them back. This is kind of boring. We want to see just, where's the mountain taking care of prisoners for us?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Well, you're right, because we've had them in that open field, or not really an open field, but that little community that they raided where that kid first showed up.
Right.
Molly, right?
That's his name? Yeah.
And then, you know, Molestown last week.
Right.
And it's crazy when you can sit here and talk about an episode which is completely filled from start to finish with battles, but it pales in comparison to the violence that you saw at the end of last week's episode.
Yeah, because it was so personal. Strange, yeah. It's very, very personal in that episode. And that always ends up happening with violence. I think it's very hard to interpret in any context the massive scope of violence unless it becomes very, very personal. And so I think that that's the big difference. Ollie and his parents, you know, Tater, the potato boy, they made it very personal. I couldn't remember his name earlier, so I was calling him Tater.
That's good.
And then,
Tater.
Yes. And then Prince O'Brien, of course. We knew him so well, but yeah, so I think we knew him so well. We cared about him. And so his death felt so much more personal, but these guys at Castle Black are sort of, in most cases, just the nameless, sweaty soldiers. And so we don't have as much attachment to them. The one guy who I think, I don't remember his name, if he had one, was the cook with his cleaver.
That was I liked awesome.
Him yeah. wrecking fools with his cleaver.
I felt like there was a lot of moments like that within this episode where we were getting a little bit of a nod towards the fan, a fan's fan. We had Dolores Ed up on the wall taking command.
Yes.
It was just like, oh, tell us a joke. I mean, it's too serious, but survive and tell us another one. You know, like I just thought it was that was beautiful. And of course, yeah, seeing the massive cleaver get put to work, those little bits were peppered here and there. And I hate to go back to Maester Aemon, but his whole, I feel like, was it a revelation? In a lot of ways, it was to me. I was just like, oh my God, am I watching him literally talking about getting with a girl right now? What does this mean for the story? This could mean anything. Anyway, next. And I just, yeah.
Well, who taught Sam about the birds and the bees? Because I feel that there's something tremendously lacking. At the beginning of the episode, one of the first lines, Sam is trying to figure out from John what sex is like. He asks Jon Snow how big Ygritte's feet were.
He was being sarcastic.
That was a joke.
He asked Jon what Ygritte was like, and he said, well, she had red hair. And he's like, oh, yeah? Well, how big were her feet? Yeah. That's not what I'm asking.
Because it was not a detail that was...
Yes,
exactly. I don't know. That's starting to paint a picture, but the feet thing threw me off. I was like, does he think that has anything to do with...
I don't think, no.
No, he was just... They was sorry.
Well, actually, Eric, it does here.
He likes feet.
Now
that's
it's,
what it is.
Okay, now let's talk about guy.
He likes to wink and suck
when
on
a man loves a woman, and when they love each other very much.
Maybe I just haven't take been off their
shoes. They buy each other shoes.
They buy each other's shoes, yeah.
That's what you do. I did like the scene where he goes to Gilly and he's saying that he's got to go fight, and then he just plants the smackaroo on her. And I out loud, I was like, damn well, Tarly.
Damn well, Tarly.
Yeah.
And then she's like, promise me you won't die. And he's like, I promise. And I was like, not a great track record on that line, guys.
I thought he was going to die after he said that. I got sad immediately when that happened.
He's
I did.
Pulling a
it's rough being on Sully going into an episode like this. Let me just say. It's just like, well, anything could happen. I literally thought, guys, going into this episode, that everyone was going to die. And that especially set in when that first vertical shot happened, that wide aerial, and I just saw all of the men. I was just like, there is no way. The entire time the mammoths were doing their thing with the giants at the gate, the entire time I wasn't looking at it and thinking, this looks great. I can't believe this is TV. I, the whole time I was watching it, I was just like, why didn't they flood the fucking tunnels?
Right.
This is bullshit.
Right.
Literally, they would have to climb if you flooded the fucking tunnels.
The Night's Watch wouldn't be able to go north and do their duty to protect the realm.
Yeah, whatever that means.
Right? Whatever the hell that means when you have a
why would you go north?
They don't need to go north.
They don't need to go north.
But Thorne admitted it.
He did. Yeah, he gave some props to John at the beginning of this episode. It was nice to see.
Big of him. Very big of him.
Yeah, he was like, we're going to live through this, and then we're going to go back to hating each other. So let's just get... It was kind of like a all right, Alistair, you're putting this shit behind you so that you can actually do your duty.
That's why I think that he's not really completely dead. Like, I think he was seriously injured. I don't think that fallen necessarily means that he's dead. I just, you know, it means that he's incapacitated on some level.
Yeah, I think so too.
They wouldn't have put the shot in of him being pulled inside if he they would have just killed him. Dead. Yeah, he would have died.
That's true.
But on top of that, I just think that and realistically, this character has been almost redeemed or completely absolved of all of his past transgressions. And I know that he's a very unpleasant person, but it's forgiveness is a very interesting thing. And in that moment, at that big of a situation with so much on the table, he let go of all of his bullshit and just laid it out. And he went out there and he kicked ass.
He did.
And
he did.
I was just like, you know what?
Yeah.
That was
the question
great.
Is then for the rest of you, well, specifically the non-book readers, who did you want to win, Thorne or Tormund?
I wanted Thorne to win.
Yeah, I wanted Thorne to kill Tormund. And along those lines, I really wanted to say, looking at the actual count, though, you're talking about who's leading these people into battle. Both Mance Rayder and Tormund are still alive, and they took Tormund, you know, for questioning or whatever. Probably a good idea. But at the same time, seeing them both alive, and then you assume that Thorne has fallen, Slint is in, you know, still alive, I guess. But just in terms of the real generals of the battle are still alive, shows that there's still a fight to come.
Mm-hmm.
It was very abrupt in a lot of different ways, and I think we're seeing a lot of disappointment from book readers that are expecting other things to come, which that kind of sucks. I was hoping for a little bit more too.
I cannot believe that next week is the finale.
Yeah, and it's got there's a lot of stuff that is going to have to be covered. Yeah,
with Jon's mission now, all of a sudden he has decided that he doesn't want command of the whole wall, I guess.
I don't know if that's true. I think he
wants to be, he's giving it up for this opportunity to go and slay Mance. Do you think he's on a vengeance quest for the death of, you know, Ygritte, or?
I think that he's doing what he can to protect the one thing that he's in charge of anymore. I think that this is his last ditch effort. He's not giving anything up, but if he wants Castle Black to stand in any way, he's got to do this, or so he thinks, right? This isn't him giving up command. This is him trying to save his brothers.
Yeah, this is his last ditch effort. I mean, he did all of the math, and like he said, I can either stay and we can fight them and lose, or I can go and at least try this, and that could work. But either way, I'm going to die.
Right.
So let's just see what happens. I'll roll the dice.
And it might not be a suicide mission, you know? Anything could happen. We just saw in the preview, he was having a face-to-face sit-down meeting with, having a conversation with Mance. So clearly they don't kill him
that
on sight.
So odd. That was just right? So odd. I'm like, I do not expect these two men to be talking. I don't.
Right. Yeah. Oh, it'll be an interesting, God. It'll be an interesting conversation.
I mean, if he can get into whatever camp Mance is at, how does he get out? It's so, and it better not be a damn cliffhanger for next season.
It could be.
It will be. It'll be a cliffhanger. This next episode is going to be 66 minutes long. Really do so much in 66 minutes.
Well, it makes up for this one.
Yeah, I know. I was bummed.
Was not very long at all. It was probably 52 minutes, if that long. I mean, it went to 9:52, but I think it started a little after 9 o'clock here.
I think what we're looking at in this situation, the way it was ended and the way that certain plot points were carried out, I think that clearly we're seeing, for the sake of the flow of the entire season, like, let's get more people to watch next week, and it's the big, 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 big episode of the finale. Mm-hmm. You know, they took that decision to say, this episode will suffer some in order to make, you know, the cliffhangerness for the next one even greater. And that's kind of a rough decision, but I doubt that's something that is made on a creative level. I guarantee you that's got to be something to do with the network, where they just have a way that they like to carry out these kinds of things.
And
that's a great point.
I think that I've read too that their CGI budget is the biggest in the finale as well. So
interesting.
This bottle episode, if that is the correct term, I think that they had a decent amount of CG that you have to do in order to make the wall work, because you have this gigantic ice wall and you needed the giants and the mammoths. And so I think that they ended up having to spend a lot of that money on whatever's coming in the next episode.
You know, something I read on Wicknet was awesome was before the visual effects were completed, before the CGI was completed, I think it was David and Dan were quoted in an article as saying that they love what Neil Marshall did and that the episode worked even without the special effects.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's a heck of an indicator that once, you know, it's finished and polished, and with the music, which in this episode I think was standout
the best. It was really beautiful.
That's ever been. Can we say that?
Maybe.
I mean, they literally had music tracks behind Tormund's fighting. It was like snarling with him as he fought. Like, he literally got his own custom soundtrack. These are the kinds of touches that we don't see in television shows, people. You know what I mean? Like, this is not normal. And I was just taken aback, honestly, by how insane that part was, but about how, you know, juxtaposed with everything at the end. And it just kind of makes me so furious, because I know that next week is just going to blow us all away much.
We've so long lived through these last couple of seasons, right, with episode 9 being the episode. Mm. And really now we're looking towards the finale actually being a finale, right? Mm-hmm. We haven't had a true finale. It's,
right,
it's been more...
They've all been falling actions.
Yeah, they've all been falling actions of episode 9, right?
Sure.
The Red Wedding, Blackwater, Ned's beheading, you know, going all the way back. I mean, you could say the ending with Daenerys in episode, you know, in season 1 was pretty epic. But, you know, since then...
Yeah.
It hasn't kind of lived up to the episode that took place before that. And I think in this season, and we've talked about it, we've had so many, quote, episode 9s that have taken so many huge events.
That's true.
That for this to live up to those episodes that have come before it in prior seasons and in this season, it had to be really, really good. And I think the episode as a whole was amazing. The battle was amazing. No question. The ending left something to be desired, and I think that
it was just weak. It seemed weak.
It was
to me.
Weak.
Yeah.
Okay. But weak, how? Like, can you quantify?
Because because you have to watch the finale, and then you might. I hope you'll better understand why we're saying that.
Right.
Yeah. No.
And I think for me, the reason this episode, as like all of the good things that I've said about this episode, I completely stand by. However, I think that this episode as a whole, and this is going to be a very unpopular opinion, I'm sure, I'm just going to say it. I thought it was a little boring because I'm not a person who's watching this show for the battle scenes. I'm not watching it for violence or for men dying in large groups. I'm watching it because it's politically intriguing. I'm watching it because I love following threads of storylines that the show doesn't. It just assumes that you're smart enough to put the clues together. I like the intellectual demand that this show places on me, and I didn't get that today.
I think it was there. I just think you had to look hard. Kate, what about Pip? The crossbow.
I prefer to see a battle, though, once in a while. Rather, especially the battles that happen in the books. When we find out that the wall has been attacked, for instance, I would hate for them to browse over it and never show it. This episode, because, as you say, it's a bottle episode, I strongly believe that's the right word for it. But, you know, you could watch this season without this episode.
Yes.
Because you can just pull it out and it doesn't affect any of the other storylines. And right. But then you would be missing not just the sacrifice that these men made and the death of fairly well-known crows, because we do like some of these guys.
Sure.
But I really do feel like there is something to be said about an episode that is sustained by battle. I wouldn't necessarily say it's boring. There were certainly issues that I had with this episode, in dialogue, actually mostly between Sam and just his promises to Gilly that he can't possibly keep. But really in the end, I mean, the character moments were still here and you do get this interplay between these men who've, let's face it, they haven't had a real, reason or a real call to action like this before. And so to see, it kind of felt like paying off everything that the Night's Watch are, in fact, their existence at the northern border, because otherwise they're just standing around just shivering fingers.
100%, yes. I think that this was a battle that the season has been building toward, and it needed to happen because we keep visiting the wall and they're like, the wildlings are coming, and then they go back to another story and you're like, okay, well, maybe the wildlings could arrive, you know? And so I think that we deserve to have this very gratifying battle scene. I think that the point that you made earlier, Eric, which is that you could pull this episode out and not only enjoy the rest of the season without it, but also enjoy it as its own thing, like its own interesting, like a little miniature film. Maybe that's what bothers me. I think that there's no besides the payoff of battle, there's no storyline that's been advanced here. Like, you could just say the wildlings are coming and then 5 minutes later, yay, most of us are still alive. Well, and then and have move John, on right
John kind of crawling out of the gate and being like, okay, I'm one of the only survivors left, we have to go find Mance.
I like this decision though from the showrunners. I like that they were as bold enough to say, this is the book. This is the story. This is something that is massively important. And not only because we're reading it and because we like it and we enjoy it and because it's canon, but because in this overarching story that hopefully will be played out over many more seasons and many more books, right now we're living a massive piece of history. There's, you know, 100,000 men of a united northern forces that just doesn't happen. Mance has united all of these tribes. We're living in the history of it happening. You know, this is something that if in Westerosian history in the future people are looking back and telling stories about, this is going to be considered on the same scales as a lot of those other majestical things from the past that we hear about.
Certainly.
And so it's like, we kind of had to do it, you know, like it had to be done. The showrunners, the people, everyone involved had to make this episode, and they had to make it like this. Did they have to cliffhang it in a certain way? Maybe not. But I feel like the decision to approach the scene from the end of the last episode and the way they did it, and in a lot of ways they approached the scenes in this episode, I think were the kinds of decisions that book readers are going to look back on. And diehard fans are going to look back on later and like appreciate that it was a decision they made that made it maybe less Hollywoody and maybe like less TV viewable in a perfect way, but really did a good job of conveying just the highly polished kind of TV that they're making, which is like unlike anything anyone else is making.
I think I want to there's a point I want to kind of guess at here. Micah and Kate can help me out, but I also think it was important from a narrative storytelling standpoint to have an episode that doesn't go away anywhere else. Because with the upcoming season, I think they're going to have, you know, well, not upcoming, I mean next year's season. With next season, I think they're probably going to have to make some interesting storytelling choices in how to deal with the cast and the characters, just based on the very few things I have heard about the next book, and the few things that have leaked with, you know, in regards to an entire new cast. So, I mean, keeping the old ones, making the balances, they're going to have these episodes that have very weird, very different, jarring type of you know, story of storylines that are visited. And I think it's important to show as well that the show can exist with just one storyline being touched on an episode. In fact, I think of an episode upcoming that may just take place in the East, or an episode upcoming that may just take place solely at King's Landing with no detracting, you know, other storylines. And that's something that interests me in terms of, do you think they could be setting up for the future and the way that they might have to handle, you know, because Game of Thrones has always been so interspersed.
That's true to the structure of the books, in my opinion, because you have all of these point of view characters and you're jumping around storylines all the time. And so you often don't get a sense of completion from those chapters. You know, they leave off, they pick up, other things are happening, and you know they're happening, but the characters don't know. So I think that the structure of jumping around between storylines works really well, personally.
Oh yeah, yeah. I won't disagree at all. Although I will say that I really felt in other episodes where they have cut away that they've kind of gotten out of having to show a lot of what we saw in this episode, which is an entire, you know, full look all the way around, again, panorama, but 360 degree view of the wall. You know, whenever something is challenging in previous episodes, it seems like they just cut away or don't show it. Or,
right.
You know, we get a very bottle, or not bottle, that's the wrong word, but we get a very straight view of each of the environments. Whereas here we really got, it felt like we got to explore it, not just because of the time that was devoted to it, but it also just felt like there was no cap on the budget or any of those other things that would cause them to skip around, you know, a whole heck of a lot between different narratives. The fact that they could just stay in one place and show us all of that place was really intriguing to me.
Well, it's the first time that they've done it in four seasons.
Oh yeah, 38 episodes, 39 episodes.
I don't think that it's going to become something that they're going to do on a regular basis. I think that it's been building to this, and it's also a situation where you have a number of different characters that you've been following for a period of time, all in one place. You know, Sam's finally back at the wall. John's finally back at the wall. You know, Eliza Thorne is there. You have Ygritte. You have Tormund. You have the Magnar of Thenn. They're all in one area, you know, and they had to wrap the story. You have Mance Rayder now coming from the north, and it's your chance to do this epic battle scene. Again, in the books, it happens in separate chapters.
Right.
So you have the advance from the south, that all takes place, and then you have what comes down from the north. So it is, you know, a little bit different, but for TV it makes sense to do it this way. What Kate said is important though. I don't think that you have to like every episode. I think that, you know, part of doing this podcast is that you can have differing opinions. We're not always going to get on here and say, oh, this is the best episode I've ever seen. I think what probably bothered book readers more than anything else was that they have very high expectations for this finale. There is a lot that takes place on a number of in a number of different storylines. And I think what they felt at the end of this episode was that things could potentially be compromised in that finale based on what was not included in this episode. And so I don't necessarily think it's unhappiness with this episode overall. I think it's unhappiness for the potential that things could not be wrapped up the way that they anticipate in the season finale. And when you talk about the timing of the episode, the fact that it was maybe left 10 minutes on the table, you know, I think that they could have done this all in one episode. They could have wrapped this storyline and left it until next season.
In 10 minutes?
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. There's not to give too much away, but there would have been a very easily impactful thing they could have done. However, I'm not wanting to go into too much detail there, but wanting to revisit another thing that sort of bothered me about this episode was that, and I try not to get too whiny about differences between the show and the books, because I actually really enjoy them, as I've mentioned in other episodes. But I wanted to mention that Pip and Gren do not die in the books. And I thought that was an egregious change. And it was because it seemed to me that they wanted that, as I said before, that personal connection to death, then, and you weren't going to get it from a character that you loved unless they killed off someone like Pip and Gren, or both for no reason. And because Ygritte's death, you don't like her anymore. You know, she's not a sympathetic character anymore. And John,
score one for Ollie.
I know. Ollie and his like bro nod. He's like, yo, I got you. I got you. And John mourns Ygritte, and I understand. And I was trying very hard to sympathize with the way they both felt about each other and the fact that they clearly still love each other. And her stupid catchphrase. I was like, man, they could have just not. Could you just not? But anyway, I think that Ygritte's death wasn't going to come off personally enough. So they, in my opinion, needlessly killed off two characters that were adorable and did not need to die.
You guys alone can say whether or not they have important things to do in the future.
Sure.
But I did find their deaths impactful as a viewer, and knowing them, knowing that they didn't necessarily die here, puts me in an interesting position as a non-book reader, because I'm like, well, that's pretty much the sign-off saying they're not going to do anything important the rest of the books, if it's okay for them to be killed, or, you know, something like that. The question I had for Mike, I guess, talking about how the attacks come in different waves, I don't think it was entirely different in this episode in one way, because the only thing you have to worry about outside besides people climbing the wall is that little gate. And the gate was more or less, you know, taken care of. The big issue, I felt that the battles were pretty separate. Even though they're occurring at once, you do have people, you know, fighting the majority on the ground, and then you have separate people making sure that people just can't get to the top of the wall. So it still felt like two separate battles to me. Even though they were happening at once and you had a few men be sent from the top to the bottom, it still was very, for me, two different battles. And so actually this whole episode felt like there were two battles.
It is two different battles, but I mean, the thing is, you're not having to fight off the Thens and the wildlings that are coming from the south at the same time that you're fighting what's coming from the north.
Right.
So yes, you're right. It was very much two battles in the show, but it was set up a little bit differently.
I just can't wait to watch this again with proper loading times. You know?
Oh, proper loading
without
times.
The whole world trying to watch it at the same time as me.
Yes.
Because I'm just looking forward to seeing all of the small details again. I'm thinking specifically of Jon Snow leaping out of the lift before it makes its way down to the ground. And it's that like amazing link roll.
But it was like 3 feet above the ground. Like, he could have just waited a minute.
No, listen. It's like the closest I've ever been to this is organized sports, and you don't wait for it to hit the ground. You jump, you roll, you kill three wildlings with a flourish.
You know, that reminded me of that scene in Galaxy Quest where Tim Allen is rolling and Sigourney Weaver is walking, and she's like, does the rolling help? And he's like, kind of. Kind of helps.
He's like dodging, rolling around corners, and she's just like shaking her head. That's exactly how I felt. I was Sigourney Weaver in that scene.
It's God. But you know what? It's funny because I wrote a note down. I guess it was one in the beginning when Sam was going down to the bottom, and I was just like, in case of fire, don't use elevator. Like, they don't really have that luxury in this option. But regarding the fire, something was pointed out to me at the beginning of my watching of this episode tonight with friends that I don't know if it was said about the Blackwater episode that Neil Marshall directed also, that there was to be found in nearly every shot of the episode an open flame. This was nearly every shot had an open flame in it. And that, more or less, to be honest, held true in this episode as well. Even if it was flames in the distance or flames in the lower left-hand corner, upper right-hand corner, whatever, there's pretty much, I mean, there is fire in every shot. Mike was talking earlier about Slint having to, you know, well, basically regressing. We all were, actually, about him basically regressing, talking about children's stories and fables. What I thought of during watching this episode was, they showed the Thân leader warging into the owl, and the owl perches on top of the wall. And I think one of the crows like sees the owl too, and is just like, "Hey, Mr. Owl, how many licks does it take to get to the center?" You know, he has no recognition of the fact that this is an owl that is being warped into. And I feel like that is a failure akin to what Micah was saying earlier about how every man, woman, and child in the free world here in Westeros really believes that giants don't exist, that dragons are fake, that all of these things that are in the stories never actually happened. And I feel like, as, you know, maybe men of the northern border, they should be trained better to recognize some of this shit that's happening up north. Seeing that the Thenn was a warg, and knowing that Bran, who's a warg, is going up north and to find a source of power of some sort that seems to be causing this type of magic, I think it would be really smart for these men to be better, and not just better prepared, but for an oral history or written history, because they have a library, to have been passed down that would kind of give these guys some more damn tools.
Well, Eric, to develop. Wait, are you suggesting that, I mean, if I'm understanding you correctly,
yeah,
I mean, they would then have to, like, see every bird and animal and insect and be like, ah, it could be a warg.
Look, like, they're on top of the wall, for one. There are no sources of food on top of the wall. So if you see a bird on top of the wall and it's not one of your own crows carrying a message, ravens carrying a message, you can probably kill it. You probably want to anyway, because you're on an ice fortress and there's no damn food. So
I feel like they had other concerns, though. You know, like this battle was about to be on their doorstep, and they're making a lot of preparations. Don't forget, mm-hmm. there are 102 of them. Having someone on bird duty is probably not a luxury they can afford.
I think I'll give you the fact that it's definitely odd for there to be an owl sitting on top of the wall. But I also agree with Kate that they had other things that they were concerned with. And should John have maybe recognized after he had been attacked last season by Orel's eagle at one point, and, you know, in the books, he actually gets cut right by his eye. So, I mean, it's a pretty serious wound that is inflicted upon him. So, I think these men believe in, you know, many more things than others do that are not at the wall. They clearly have experienced White Walkers, and they know that there is some magical power out there. So if there are White Walkers, why not wargs? Why not giants? Why not mammoths? And now they've seen all these things. Should they be taught on it? Maybe, but I don't think, you know, that they have the resources. When we get to Castle Black, it's depleted. You know, there's only, you know, Eastwatch by the bay and
Shadow Tower.
The Shadow Tower, right. So, you know, it's very limited. It's not as if the wall is fortified in the same way where it can have the same level of training possibly and have the same level of study as in the past.
You're right.
But I want to talk about, you know, some of these other deaths that occurred in this episode, particularly Ygritte. And, you know, did you see this coming? The non-book readers, obviously, with everything that happened with Tater, as we're now calling him, leading up to this, episode, because they did do a fair bit of foreshadowing.
I thought everyone was going to die. So
that's right. You said that.
when this happened, I was very sad. I was just like, no. And then that's about all I could feel, because we were in the middle of a battle. It was pretty the way they clutched each other and the camera slowly moved away. And I really enjoyed all of it. And I'm glad that it was the kid that did it, because at the end of the day, it's a little tiny bit of retribution on his end. And it was less of a, I'm going to get mad at someone else. Like, for a second, I thought it was going to be Sam, because he had that crossbow earlier. And I thought maybe he'd snuck out somewhere and shot an arrow, because maybe he doesn't like Ygritte. The way he makes his friend, she's just like, well, sometimes Sam. You get like a jealous of your like friend's girlfriend or something. He just, yeah, maybe,
if you think, you know, about it, it was Sam, though, because Sam told the kid to arm himself.
Yeah, but the kid, I mean, she killed his parents, or, you know, with the Thenn raided.
She had a hand, yeah,
raided his village. My surprise is that John didn't also get shot. You know, you don't want to shoot somebody who's holding a gun, because the gun might go off, you know, that sort of thing. So I was just glad that she kind of made an effort to set the bow and arrow down after she got unexpectedly killed. You know, thing was poised. It was ready to fire. I mean, it was a dangerous situation to be in for anybody choosing to kill her right then and there.
It's just unfortunate for these characters to be locked in this situation whatsoever. And I think that, you know, the bit with Tormund at the end was another great sort of view into what John was going through a season ago. Whereas, you know, I didn't feel that much animosity between them two. I know that he was being captured, and for a second, I'm sure he imagined he was about to be executed.
And I think he knows that he's, you know, off to be questioned, as they say. He's just kind of expecting it, and he's probably expecting to resist their interrogation for a time.
And the Magner of Then, who got...
the hammer in the head.
Yeah, MC Hammered.
You know, I was surprised Ygritte didn't kill him, honestly, and then point the arrow at John, because she made it very clear that she wanted John for herself.
I had the same thought, yeah.
Right? So when this big-ass guy comes and is, like, really nearly killing John, smashing his face into the anvil, for instance, would have been a great time for Ygritte to fire that arrow. I was there, standing there cheering, going, hey, Ygritte, fire that arrow now, you know, kill one of your own, but in order so that you get to kill John and still falter and not do it. But I'm glad John was able to pull the hammer.
I did want to bring up one more thing, though, before we wrap this up and get to our owns. The ending of this episode reminded me a lot of the episode. I don't know if it was at the end or if it was just in, you know, somewhere in the episode, but when Sam says goodbye to Bran and Hodor, it was almost the same type of shot.
Oh, yeah.
Where they're walking off north of the wall.
True.
I still don't
like the ending.
Did Sam just have like an automatic garage door opener or something? He just pushed a button and the gate opened?
He waved his open flame.
You didn't see the open flame get waved? I don't know how you missed that.
No, he really did. He waved.
Are we joking? Is this a joke?
No, he waved a torch and...
Who was looking at that? Who's at the top of
the door opener?
Important questions we raise in the podcast.
Ollie. It was Ollie. Tater. We'll go more in depth into this episode later on in the week, but I think it's that time. You know what time it is?
It's own time.
So who wants to own?
I'm gonna do mine so that you guys don't take it. The giant with the giant arrow that came through, and that damn shot. Oh my god! Yeah. The one that made contact with an unfortunate brother of the Night's Watch. And just for morale's sake, where that body landed with the largest. It must have been like an all-metal arrow, where it landed right in the middle of the courtyard as the men were fighting.
It was like a spear.
Quickest way over the wall.
It was really a harpoon, except
it is the quickest way over the
wall.
Damn. That's fantastic.
He should just be, shooting his brethren over.
I thought he got grim with it for a second. I was really sad.
Yeah, me too.
That actually would have been better, to be honest with you. If they're going to kill him off, they should have done it in an epic way.
I mean,
it wasn't an epic way. He was serving.
I think Gren died very epically. I liked his death. But
on the other hand,
he didn't need to die.
They could have done that to Pip.
It was sad, and we'll get into it on Friday. There's so much more to talk about, damn it.
Owns. I'm going to give my own to Ghost, because...
Good call.
He gets unleashed... John uses Ghost, and it's super effective.
It was.
Why the hell didn't they do that first?
Well, I'm just glad Ghost is okay.
Why were we 40 minutes into the episode before Ghost gets unleashed? Like,
and he says this line to Sam. He's like, "I need him more than I need you." And I was like, "Ouch, bro."
I thought it was the key to Aemon's quarters or something. Like, go get Aemon.
He's going to turn into a dragon and kill
Maester Aemon.
Exactly.
He like comes out all Yoda. And bouncing around.
The blood of the dragon. That's what
he could. Oh, absolutely. I have full faith in Maester Aemon. He could totally do that.
At first, I was like, why is Maester Aemon locked in his room?
I have to give my own to Elizer Thorne for reasons already stated. I think he owns most of the episode.
Yeah.
Some of our
just
hearts.
In terms
surprisingly.
Of his, willingness to admit that he was wrong to John on top of the wall, and then his willingness to be the first to lead the charge when he heard that the wildlings were attacking from the south, his pretty epic battle with Tormund, and we'll see what happens to him moving forward. But hopefully, given this change of character a bit, he might be a good person for John to have around moving forward.
You know, you've told us your dislike for him so vehemently over the past few years, and you knew this. You knew this, and that makes it worse.
Well, first of all, he was referred to as Snape, right?
So right.
Snape has that redeeming moment in Deathly Hallows. So
no spoilers, Micah. I still haven't read.
Maybe this is his redeeming moment.
Oh, okay. Well, I will give my own to a Mr. Jon Snow. For kicking ass in 17 different ways, he rose up to be, let's just call him Lord Commander right now, just for one episode.
Lord Commander Snow.
That was
kind of
cool.
That? Lord Commander, name of a bastard, not highborn, but just kicked ass.
Doing the role, incredible blocking in the fight scenes. I thought it was great, but just, I felt like it was strange, but for a moment, the wall was comfortable. I know we were in the middle of a battle, but I felt like the guys, you know, with John and Gren and his buds, like calling the shots, I just felt comfortable and I felt like they were actually going to work hard because for so long we've had to deal with stuff at the wall not being exactly what we needed to be. And they've always taken orders from stubborn people, but I felt like these guys were like, it was kind of like the Battle of Hogwarts almost in a way. When the kids are making decisions, it sort of felt that way where it was like, all right, I'm going to trust you right now. And I think that the trust that they all had in each other and just how awesomely they were all fighting was not only cool to watch in the TV show, but for me, really helped me like these characters even more.
Can I say also that Jon Snow is trending in the US and they don't spell his name right?
Really?
All right. Well, in lieu of spelling things correctly, I think it's all time for us to move toward a more you-centric part of our show where we say things that you wrote to us over this majestical evening. Yes, we are recording right after it's over. This is Eric Skull. Read the tweets in
however long it takes me less.
Go!
Eddie Bogoslowski says, I don't have to watch another second to know that, quote, Pip opened the fucking gate, end quote, is the own of the episode. Kevin Bloomfield says, own to Sir Alistair for being an asshole who knows how to lead. They're Rutgers, and you don't always like them, but you'll defend them.
All right.
Okay.
David Ludwig, quote, you know nothing, Jon Snow.
Somber.
Nostalgic own right there.
Somber.
Mary Larson, this week's own is to the director, Neil Marshall, for that awesome long shot that showed the whole battle on that gate.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Giselle G says, my own goes to Gren. He held the gate and owned the giant. And nearly seconds later, from Michael Ash, same thing. Own to Gren for defending the gate and killing a giant.
Miss you, Gren.
You know, those four men who assisted Gren are not getting any loves thus far.
And Gren's friends.
Friends.
Nathan Larson says, so many own-worthy moments. My own goes to the big ass-swinging axe.
Scythe.
I love that thing.
I just called it an anchor, but I guess it was more than that. It was just like...
They called it a scythe, I believe.
Scythe,
I'm so glad that they put that in.
Amy Wilson says, first time I cried for a Game of Thrones death. Really, this is heartless. Quote, remember that cave? Question mark.
Was it tears of joy or laughter?
When facing death, the best place to live is in the past. Yes, Eamon says something very similar in this episode. Bill Bennett says John Henry Snow owns a hammer, and he knows how to use it.
Yes, he does.
Manuel Paredes says this episode owned the audience by leaving us with sword cuts, a hammer in head, and an arrow through our collective throats.
Very clever. I like that.
You know, in the middle of all of these owns on Twitter, we have a question from Benjamin Smith. What happened? Exclamation, exclamation, question, question, exclamation, exclamation. OMG, did Ned Stark come back from the dead and re-kill Joffrey?
Not yet.
Not yet. I'm fully expecting that in the finale.
A lot is promised for next episode.
Ned Stark is a headless White Walker.
Dead Stark.
Game of Thrones. Dead Stark.
Yeah, Dead Stark.
Undead Stark.
Because Ned rhymes with dead guys.
Get it?
Steve.
Get it?
Yeah.
Steve. More like Dead Stark.
Steve Harvey.
Steve from Philly. Says Ollie owned. That's it. That's just the tweet. Ollie owned.
Agreed. Ollie owned.
Ollie did.
Judd Blevins. Own goes to Gren for telling Slint to GTFO and for rallying his brothers. Definitely agree. That was the most badass moment for Gren, I thought, in this episode.
It was great. I loved it.
Kevin A says Sam owned by finally kissing Gilly and taking charge.
It was consensual.
Jill agrees. Mine goes to Sam for owning Gilly's lips. And finally, Rachel Edmondson says my own goes to the mammoth. Because, well, he's a fucking mammoth.
And that was Eric Skull. Tweet, tweet, in.
However long it took him or less.
Fantastic, Eric. I like the mammoth one.
Oh, yeah. That was a woolly.
I just saw the mammoth on TV again. He stepped on somebody when he was running
away.
That's
what you do when we're reading the tweets. You're watching it again. Well, don't despair, people. It's something we'll be doing probably frequently over the course of this week before we bring you our next episode, which I think will go even deeper inside of what we've seen. I just feel like we've talked about swords and shields. There are souls to be spoken of, people.
Mm-hmm. And we got to look ahead to the finale, what we think is going to happen, possibly.
Check out that preview. I want to dissect that preview.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
There's something, yes, there's like a two-headed creature, maybe two dragons in close corridors, but... I couldn't quite tell.
Could be.
So we will look forward to your owns being placed to us throughout the week because we will probably be needing them to assist us in our episode. Mm-hmm.
And those much-needed iTunes reviews as well.
Yep.
Just kidding. We're not on iTunes.
Nope.
We read tweets from this evening's episode that were sent to us via our Twitter, which is twitter.com/GameOfOwns. Guys, the wall is still standing, and you know what this means. It means that there is still time to scrawl upon our wall, our Facebook wall, of course, facebook.com/GameOfOwns for that. And you can still email us. The lines are still open because the men did not dig underground and sever those connections. So email us at contact@GameOfOwns.com, and your email will be promptly received and read. And sometimes we read those on the show as well, as our iTunes reviews.
As Eric mentioned, you can rate and review us on iTunes, and we'll hopefully read them sometime in the near future. I'm not going to commit to any day of
we'll
the week.
Try for Friday, but we'll see.
We're going to try for Friday, at least to pull a few. Maybe like five or so. We know that they're there. We see them. But, you know, it is a great way for others to find out that we exist. You know, it's...
Tell the others about us.
It's a big world. It's a big world out
there.
Tell
the others. You know, we loved them.
You taking a few moments out of your day to just head on over to the place you download us and let us know that you enjoy listening to us. We're going to put you in, if you don't rate and review us at least 5 stars, we're going to put you in an underground tunnel with a big ass giant.
Yeah, try to hold that gate.
Man, you guys like to like blackmail and threaten our listeners, don't you?
Oh, yeah, that's what we do. That's
it used to
thing.
Be a thing.
Oh, yeah,
the way it works.
We'll bring it back.
I see. Yeah,
we've had some really, really crazy threats. When Christian came on for the first time, we had him to give a threat, and he threatened to slap people with his Hodor penis if they didn't.
Oh, my God. He texted me a picture of that once.
What?
Oh, God.
But it wasn't attached to his body. It was, like, on his bathtub.
Well, that's good.
It was good is one word for it. Alarming is another.
No, it's good that it wasn't attached to his body, is what I'm saying.
And on that note...
Ladies and gentlemen, listeners of all ages out there, we lost many brothers of the Night's Watch this evening, and as well as a number of the free folk who were fighting for a cause. And so the next time you go to a local pub or brewery or have a drink at home, be sure to pour one out for the lost brothers of the Night's Watch.
And pour one out for us, the lost friends of Game of Owns. We'll see you on Friday.
See you then.
Dinklage, take it away, Kate.
Take it away.
La 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 la.